Hi, my name is Rabbi Jack Benfrod, and I'm the director of for the Center for Interreligious Understanding in New Jersey. I've been doing this for at least 30 years. That is relating to other religions and finding ways in which religions can work together, better together, so that they not only understand one another, but appreciate one another and learn to work together for the common good. I've also, for the last 16 years, been teaching at the Pontifical St. Thomas Aquinas University in Rome, and I'm presently the director there of the John Paul II Center for Interreligious Studies. And there, what we do is we give fellowships and scholarships to students all over the world to come and get a license or a doctorate in interreligious studies, so that when they then are graduate and go and work in the community all over the world, they can convey this message of peace, mutual understanding, and the capacity to learn how and effectively work with one another.
Good morning. My name is Imam Abdullah Antepli. I am the Muslim chaplain and faculty of Islamic Studies here at Duke University. I also find interfaith work, bridge building between different faith communities, trying to make religion a source and force of peace in this difficult and broken world of ours, where often it's been used as source and force of violence and division. I consider this a significant part of our work. I think across the board, all clergy, they can no longer see their role limited to serving to their own particular community. I think part of their formational and educational growth should be also how to outreach to other faith communities and establish alliances and partnerships and work for common good, as Rabbi Jack Benfrod said.
I think we face a very, very clear and serious challenge today, and that is that you have this kind of going to extremism, and the extremism is not only religious but also political. And the problem is that extremes have a great deal of difficulty talking to one another. All they know how to do is vilify one another and condemn and hate one another. And I think that it's like when Yeats in his great poem says, the center does not hold. And so we've got to find some way of telling the truth about these things rather than just indulging in propaganda and condemnation. And I think here, this is a responsibility for all of our religious groups to seek the truth and try to tell the truth. Now, when it comes to Islam, I think that it's unfortunate that so much of the media and the press has focused on only one dimension and have excluded all other dimensions, so that what you have is a vilification, a character assassination, and the total misunderstanding of the true nature of Islam.
And the constant dehumanization of people who adhere to Islam, Muslims as people. All the recent polls have been showing that American society at large have been extremely vulnerable, increasingly vulnerable towards the information that they are receiving about Islam and Muslims. And more than overwhelming majority of Americans, they either have negative views of Islam, or they see Islam and Muslims or Muslim values as irreconcilable with American values. There's a recent poll, I don't know if you have seen, regarding the Congressman King's hearing about American Muslim community, whether or not Americans agree that American Muslim community, 6 to 8 million Muslims living in the United States, is posing any potential threat to American safety and security. And again, the numbers are really high, especially among particular communities, that more than 50% of people across the board agrees with the basic sentiment of that hearing.
Yes, the sad thing, of course, is that people repeat what they hear.
Yes.
They have no real means of investigating for themselves. And I think part of the problem is the fact that the Muslim community itself is uncertain and unclear, A, how to unite against this challenge, and secondly, even if they were to unite, they're not clear what to do about it. And this is a real problem.
But, I mean, those are two very significant challenges facing with American Muslim community here. First of all, our amazing diversity, ethnic, cultural, theological, sectarian diversity is right now mostly working against us. We are not able to come as American Muslim community and in one voice respond to this challenge. And even if we come together in certain aspects, we basically do not necessarily seem to identify what needs to be done and how needs to be done. And that is the whole conversation with you today as one of the mentors, to talk a little bit about American Jewish experience. How, in what ways, Jewish inclusion to the social fabric of American society, and because I think Judaism as religion and Jews as people, they went through a similar experience when they first arrived in big numbers to this part of the world. Can you talk a little bit about the whole Jewish struggle to humanize themselves, rebrand themselves, and get accepted in the American society?
Well, it seems to me there are similarities and differences that we should pay attention to. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that the Jewish community has, over the centuries, been treated with contempt in the religious teachings of Christianity. Mm. It was Jules Isaac who met with Pope John the 23rd and said, look, what you've been teaching about Jews and Judaism happens not to have anything to do with what Jews and Judaism really believe or who they are. Mm. And it was to the great credit of John the 23rd that he actually initiated Vatican II, where the Catholic Church thought through what they had been teaching in the past. And they came to the conclusion that it's true, mm. that much of what they were saying about Jews and Judaism was wrong. Mm. And here, I think, one has to keep in mind that whatever civil rights a religion obtains in any society is held hostage to the extent that they're given religious rights. If they're not seen as a religion that is an authentic, meaningful religion, mm. I would say whatever civil rights Jews or Muslims or anyone would get are held in hostage. And so the real problem is not just to fight, as the Jewish community discovered, for their civil rights, so that they were, for example, allowed to go to schools, engage in professions and things like mm-hmm. that, which I think when they first came here, there was a great deal of discrimination against the Jewish community, also against Catholics, by the way.
Sure.
This was predominantly a Protestant country.
Sure.
And both Jews and Catholics had to fight for civil rights. But the reality is that even those civil rights didn't hold unless religious rights were granted. Mm. And one of the things that bothers me is that in this condemnation and character assassination of the Muslim community, what you have is a vilification of the religion.
Yes.
And so the question is, how do you make that religion be properly understood? That seems to be the challenge. Now, with respect to Judaism, because of the Jewish connection with Christianity, the fact that the Hebrew Bible is actually part of the Christian Bible, mm-hmm. it's viewed as the Old Testament to which the Christians add and combine and join a New Testament, one couldn't really quite totally defame the Jewish religion mm. without at the same time defaming themselves. Now, in other words, the Catholic Church has always rejected Marcionism, who actually said the only valid scriptures are the letters of Paul, part of Luke, and the whole of the Old Testament had to be rejected. Mm. I mean, while there are Marcion tendencies and have been throughout the Christian community throughout history, the reality is Marcionism was rejected, and so the Jewish religion had less of a difficulty in achieving acceptance as a religion. Mm-hmm. But I think here what you have is really total ignorance when it comes to Islam. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, when I remember when I was as a rabbi in Marion, Indiana in 1954, and I asked my confirmation class to invite their Christian friends, because in those days there were no Muslims in Marion, Indiana.
there are so many now.
Yeah, I don't really know. But what I'm saying is that they wouldn't come. Mm-hmm. You couldn't find a Christian. You couldn't find, for example, a Protestant caught dead in a Catholic church, or vice versa, or certainly not in a synagogue.
Interesting.
And it was really John. It was really not just the visit of John Paul II to the synagogue in Rome in 86, but before mm-hmm. that, you have the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King, and what he did is he mobilized all of the religious leadership, Jewish and Christian, mm-hmm. And secular, obviously, to unite for the civil mm-hmm. rights movement. Mm-hmm. And that, in many ways, broke the barriers that were set mm-hmm. up between religions. Mm-hmm. Now,
on the part of Jewish community, though, I'm sure it wasn't just Pope or the church leaders changing the policies of the church. There was on the part of the Jewish community a lot of effort and investment being done in order to explain the true nature of Judaism, in order to make Judaism as an acceptable religion. And Jews as acceptable people. What have the Jewish community have done vis-a-vis what we just talked about, Islam and Muslim community? How did they come up with an organized voice despite the amazing
difference?
Well,
I think here I must say it was a tragedy. What happened is that with the Second World War and with Hitler and his propaganda, based, by the way, on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that literally Jews were vermin and something repulsive and dirty that would contaminate the world and had to be rejected. What happened is a whole series of groups that at one time had been more organized to say, let's tolerate one another, let's respect one another, let's accept one another. All of a sudden, you had all these defense agencies arise. Mm. And then the Jewish community united behind these defense agencies, which in a sense had to unite the Jews. It couldn't be just Orthodox, conservative, Reform, labor Zionists, Zionists, secularists. The Jewish community had to unite and say, look, we have to stand up to the kind of propaganda that Hitler and defend. And not only that, we have to do whatever we can to help the Jews who were being persecuted and exterminated.
Right, right.
And so that challenge brought the Jewish community together, and we set up a number of organizations whose main task was not necessarily to teach Judaism or to teach the Bible or the Talmud, but whose main task was to actually confront this kind of vilification and defamation.
Can you talk a little bit more about the other side of the story? Can you talk a little bit more about those number of organizations and institutions that American Jewish
community... Well, you have the American Jewish Committee, you have the Anti-Defamation League, you have the American Jewish Congress, you have B'nai B'rith, mm-hmm. you have a whole series of organizations who actually organize themselves to try to defend the attacks that were being made against Jews and Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that is perhaps important for the Muslims to consider is to find organizations or to set up organizations that are not Shiite or Sunni
yes.
or, you know, strictly concentrated on the mosque,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But really to find a way of A, getting the best minds in the Jewish and Christian community mm-hmm. to help them.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean you need to organize it through rebranding, proper communication. You need to get people who have spoken out in defense of the Muslim community, mm-hmm. like President Bush, President Clinton, mm-hmm. etc., to speak out again mm-hmm. forcefully on this.
Mm-hmm.
We also need to find ways of engaging in communication between imams and rabbis and ministers. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, when I was president of the Dallas Pastors Association, we had 2,000 members in Dallas.
Wow.
There was not one Muslim.
Not a one Muslim clergy.
Not one. And I'm saying we have to now begin to integrate into these associations the imams.
Mm.
I spoke last week in San Antonio, and we had a number of imams that came.
Right.
And I must say, my heart went out to them because they feel like they're acting like deer in front of headlights.
Yes, yes.
They don't understand it. They don't understand how people who at one time they thought were friends
mm-hmm.
are now attacking them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the issue, you see. And I think the Muslim community is going to have to, A, organize itself and then reach out to mm-hmm. the best elements in the Jewish and Christian community and say, look, let's unite
mm-hmm.
so that we can somehow challenge. Meet this challenge.
Right.
That's the task.
Right. Let's stay a little bit more on the organizing itself part. Like, how did the Jewish community, how the very Orthodox, very Reform, left and right, they were able to form these organizations that you have mentioned and come up with a kind of, how did they work with their own diversity within themselves? You said there was an external threat, and this was a surviving mode after post.
Well, I think there are a number of reasons, and these are not simple reasons. The first is that you had in the 19th century the rise of Zionism, which is a Jewish movement, which is a secular movement, which said that anti-Semitism, and by the way, falsely in my opinion, anti-Semitism will never end unless Jews have a state of their own, which is a secular state, totally separate from religion. Mm-hmm. And so you had the tremendous Zionist movement. You then have labor Zionists, people who were concerned with the working people, the working classes, because especially in the migration of 1890 to 1905, 1910, you had a massive 1.7 million Jews coming from Eastern Europe, Russia and Eastern Europe, and they came here and worked in sweatshops. Mm. And so what you had is Jews were the beginning of the organizers of the labor movement in the United States were Jews. And so you had labor Zionists. Mm. The other thing is, in view of the fact that Judaism has been so vilified by those communities that were primarily religious, they have always felt that it's the secular civil rights that they receive that would protect them against state religions. Mm. And so you therefore not only had a Zionist movement, you also had a secular movement within Judaism. And that helped because all of a sudden the question, given the pogroms of 1905, given the vilification of Jews and the Dreyfus case in Europe, you had a history where they said, look, we've got to defend ourselves as a people, not just as Orthodox, conservative, or Reform. Mm. And so what happened was that you had the development right there. You have the seeds for the development of organizations that would take the whole concept of Kalal Yisrael, which I guess can loosely be termed as the peoplehood of Israel. Mm-hmm. The sense of peoplehood among the Jews is basically overwhelmingly. Let me give you an example. Perhaps the largest contributors to Israel in the Jewish community in the United States are Reform.
Mm.
And the Reform Jews are not really very well treated in Israel in the sense that Reform rabbis can't function as rabbis
right.
in Israel.
They cannot even,
that
they
doesn't
cannot
prevent
even practice.
Them from contributing tremendously to all programs that would somehow help Jews go to Israel from countries where they've been persecuted.
Mm.
Keep in mind, 1 million Jews came from Arab countries into Israel.
Right.
And if it was left to the Orthodox to actually make that possible, it would have been impossible.
Forget about supporting. They couldn't get in.
They couldn't get in. That's the point. Mm. And so what you have is, first, a commitment to Muslims. That's what I would say has to be. Mm. Regardless if you're Sunni or Shiite or religious or not religious, the degree of assimilation and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, a real attempt to show what the true teachings of Islam. What are these true teachings?
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that has to be told.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, there has to be some way. For example, I think you know that in an op-ed piece that Marshall Brieger, Suhail Khan, and Jim Kowalski and I wrote for the Washington Post, we listed all the places where Imam Siddiqui and other Muslim leaders condemned suicide bombings, condemned terrorism, condemned Osama bin Laden. No one knew anything about it. So when these things take place, there's got to be some way of broadcasting it. Give it a megaphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's being done. I mean, look, when I spoke in Baltimore before 2,000 Muslims,
right.
When I mentioned these things, I said, you didn't see this in the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or USA Today. In fact, I said, how many people here know about it? And these were Muslims, and they didn't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Muslims.
That's the tragedy.
Muslims themselves, they have been internalizing this vilification of Islam, and they don't necessarily see or hear the true message of Islam in for the most part.
Correct.
But unfortunately, I think we are just talking the heart of the matter now. The real difficulty in light in the face of this ugly attack against Islam and Muslims, what makes Muslims and American society at large very vulnerable and makes situation a lot more difficult is Muslim house is not in order. I don't think the existing American Muslim organizations, they do not necessarily fill this need and gap and represent the entire Muslim community. For the most part, I see Muslim American Muslim community, they have three major challenges. First is, unfortunately, they are divided between different ethnic lines. There is a major divide between African-American Muslim community, indigenous Muslim community, and the immigrant Muslim community. And within the immigrant Muslim community, those immigrant elements and the post-colonial experiences that they brought with them is still playing a significant role and keeps the walls between different Muslim communities intact and strong.
Yes.
And it's amazing and how inspiring that the Jewish community around ethnic and racial issues, as diverse as it is, somehow committed to this overarching Jewish identity, and they made a strong commitment to Jewish people as people.
Yes.
Not as Ashkenazi, not as Sephardic, as Yemeni Jews or Ethiopian Jews or European or Middle Eastern Jews, etc. That's quite amazing. The second biggest challenge that we are facing, which seems to be by and large solved within the Jewish community, is the sectarian divide. Like, we still do not know how to process and present a one united picture as Sunnis and Shias. Our commitment is pretty much our own sect or school of thought. But the third biggest challenge, to me the most difficult challenge, I think to me that's the biggest need and the help that the Muslim community needs is Muslim community is divided between, I don't even know how to frame it, like between less religious, more practicing, less practicing, whose experience counts, who has an authority to speak on behalf of Islam. And in that, it seems the existing national Muslim organizations are pretty much represented by more traditional, more practicing, more religious Muslims, which I personally be part of and belong to. Mm-hmm. But that's only a small percentage of the Muslim community. Overwhelming Muslim community has a wide spectrum of different level of practices, different understandings, and different affiliations with Islam. Somehow, their voice, their experience are not represented in existing national Muslim organizations.
Yes. I think that what one needs to do, if I can make a suggestion, and I don't have answers to these. These are gigantic problems, but my suggestion would be that the various organizations and various ethnic groups form a blue ribbon committee.
Hmm.
And that committee would hire a rebranding and communication structure.
Hmm.
And that rebranding and communication structure would develop a plan very much like a political campaign where you want to introduce and elect a candidate.
Hmm.
And then you have to say, okay, who are going to be the PR people who have contact with the press?
Mm.
Who are those people that have contact with TV? Who are those that have contact with churches and synagogues?
Mm.
There's no reason in the world
mm-hmm.
why you can't mobilize, say in New York, the New York Board of Rabbis, which has over 2,000 rabbis,
mm.
and speak to them and say, here's material that you can teach in your congregations. You can do the same thing with the National Council, the National Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Right.
And once you develop a strategy,
mm-hmm.
like get the proper rebranding group, get the proper communications group, have liaisons with the National Catholic Bishops, with the World Council and National Council of Churches,
mm-hmm.
with the United Lutheran Federation, with all the various religious groups and say, look, we need your help in going to your congregations and actually telling the truth about Islam. We will send speakers to you.
Right.
And you have to get a cadre of speakers.
Mm-hmm.
The moment something happens where there's real falsification going on, and that happens very often,
right.
you have to have high-profile individuals who have a following to, at a moment's notice, go on Charlie Rose, mm-hmm. go on, you know, the Situation Room, mm-hmm. go on Hardball or whatever the programs are.
60 Minutes.
And say, look, this Larry isn't the King. Case. Look, let me just ask you a simple question. On Fox News, you have nothing but vilification of Islam. How many imams have been invited that you know and that you trust to somehow tell, say anything about Islam?
No, I mean, first of all, we have made no genuine and real attempt to basically to be heard by these media outlets.
That's the problem.
And the second of all, they don't seem to be interested with a peaceful message of Islam. They seem to just go after all these crazies,
yes,
and
exactly.
and amplify their crazy messages in a sensational mode.
Right.
It's a both way street. But I think you beautifully diagnosed the whole PR and the communication and the rebranding challenge that we are facing vis-à-vis Islam and Muslims. And it's such an expensive endeavor. It will require a lot of investment, financial and otherwise.
Yeah, and, but you see, if you don't put the investment, all you're going to do is say, we're playing dead and let the enemy win.
Yes. And it's how disheartening, despite this huge task in front of us, the Muslim communities in the United States are still putting most of their energy and investment building mosques, building one mosque after another. They have been spending most of their energy and financial resources for one building, one fancy building after another fancy building. Do you think building impressive mosques will, first of all, bring the Muslim community together and make any difference in terms of American society's ability to understand and accept Islam and Muslims?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think it's going to be counterproductive, because what it does is give a visible representation of the influence of Islam, which, if falsely understood, will be attacked.
Hmm.
That's why you have in community after community, you know, people getting together saying no more mosques.
Yes. Yes.
Not just in the United, not just here in New York, but all over the country. Now, look, keep in mind that the Muslim community have lived for generations in peace with the American people
right.
in this country.
Right.
Now, why can't we recapture that? Why, but you see, part of the problem has to be that what are you going to do with when an Ahmadinejad gets up in the name of Islam mm-hmm. and says the most horrendous things?
Mm-hmm.
The Muslim community has to get up and attack them.
Exactly.
And it has to be an attack. It can't just be silence.
It can't be a silence. And it can't
be silence.
unambiguous yes and
exactly.
buts. I mean, it has to be unambiguous, clear condemnation of these kind of crazy voices.
Exactly.
We have to somehow able to marginalize these people and tell the entire world that their voice, in terms of their representation within the Muslim community, is insignificant and not substantial.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but how do you get people to believe that? That's the question.
Yes. How do you see other communities, but particularly the American Jewish community, imagine the Muslims put their house in order and came up with an organized voice, how the American Jewish leadership could be a partner and ally to Muslim community?
Well, I think so. Well, I think there's no question that the resources of the Jewish community would be made available to the Muslims. In the same way that the resources of the Jewish community have always been made available, like in the civil rights movement. Keep in mind, right now, the largest contributors to black colleges are Jews.
Hmm.
In spite of the increasing anti-Semitism among, you know, the black community.
Hmm.
So what you've got is a situation where if it's a cause for religious freedom, if it's a cause for freedom of speech,
right.
if it's a cause for the rights of human beings, the Jewish community on the whole has such a tradition of that.
Mm.
I mean, it is so basic to being Jewish
mm.
that they would have to be false to themselves if they didn't endorse that.
Mm.
And I, I'm not a leader, but as a voice in the Jewish community, I could mobilize literally hundreds of rabbis
mm.
to help you.
Mm.
Keep in mind that when the Pope came to Israel, we mobilized hundreds of rabbis praising the Pope for his courage to go to Israel and for condemning Holocaust denial.
Right.
Now, that's where we got the idea that the Muslims, if they would do that, it would be a wonderful thing, that no good Muslim can be a Holocaust denier. And it was Marshall Brieger who says, let's go do it in Auschwitz, which basically was the foundation for our trip.
For the audience who doesn't know about the trip, do you want to talk a little bit about post-trip? Like, what did it mean for eight imams to go and make this journey and pilgrimage to learn more about Holocaust and the statement that we unanimously...
I think that statement is a remarkable statement that's been translated in a number of languages. It's been sent all over. Mm-hmm. And what it shows is the willingness and the ability of imams, leading imams in the United States, to tell the truth. That's the amount, that's what it really amounts to. Mm-hmm. Now imagine if that could be done on a whole series of issues and not just Holocaust denial.
Yes.
Now I, for example, I spoke to Father McManus, who is literally the secretary of Archbishop Dolan. Archbishop Dolan would be delighted to invite all of you to come to New York and to congratulate you, and to actually, we would get a lot of press. And New York would be a good place to get that press.
Definitely.
Because of the whole situation where you have 70% of the people in New York saying they're opposed to this center, which includes, by the way, a mosque, a chapel, and a synagogue, you know.
And a 9/11 memorial.
Yes. So what I'm saying is that would be a very good first step. But here again, you have to have some unity in the Muslim community that would decide to do that.
One other challenge is, how could you help Muslims who unfortunately pay more attention to those Jewish voices within the community who basically bought the entire post 9/11 message and propaganda about Islam and Muslims? And in their reflection, of what's going on about Islam and Muslims, they show no or very little empathy that this is basically what their ancestors went through. How can the Muslim community marginalize these voices who are unfortunately discouraging people to build bridges between Judaism and Jewish community and the Muslim community?
Well, I think the first thing that has to be done is that we have to have a lot of communication. So we have to have ongoing meetings between the Muslim community and rabbis. I mean, well, I can facilitate that. For example, if you can get some of the imams in New York City, and they have met, but I think on a regular basis with the New York Board of Rabbis, with the New Jersey Board of Rabbis, with the Central Conference of American Rabbis, with the Rabbinical Assembly, with all the various rabbinical groups, if we can get the heads of our rabbinical schools, I could do that because I know them, together with whoever heads of the seminaries, the Islamic seminaries. That would be something that would be helpful.
Sure.
And the more of that, the better it is, you see. And, but part of the problem is that the Jewish community, unfortunately, to a large extent, is also victim to the same kind of propaganda and disinformation that's taking place all over the country.
Yes. Yes, unfortunately.
And you see, we need to find... And unless the Muslims do it, we can't do it for them.
Yes.
Once they do it, then we can join them. You see my point?
Yes, yes, yes.
That's really the problem.
How can we, do you think, empower the more secular, less practicing, maybe in the left side of the spectrum, Muslim community to organize themselves and not necessarily leave it to more traditional, more practicing Muslims to be in the business of representing Islam and Muslims? How did the Jewish community, for example, the whole Reconstructionist Judaism and the Reform Judaism in the United States, how did they form themselves and partner with the rest of the Jewish Jewish community in the United States?
Well, I think you have to understand that when the first migration of Jews in this country were basically Sephardic Jews. In 1654, 23 Jews came to New York destitute and organized a community. The first thing they did was they actually set up a cemetery and a school. The synagogue, but they didn't do a synagogue. They did a school because they felt the most important thing was to educate their children. You could pray anywhere, you see. And then the next migration was the German migration, and those had a large percentage of liberal or reformed Jews. The Orthodox Jews came later. And so you already had a reform community that set the ground rules for working with the secular community. Because the reform community was the one that had had most experience in Germany and Europe to actually find a way of connecting to the European society. So they learned the languages, they studied the texts, they were very, very knowledgeable. Plus, you had a situation where the German Jewish community came over largely because the German community, with the crisis of 1848 and the abortive revolution of 1848, they came in large numbers. And then later with the Homestead Act, where the United States gave free land to people who would come and cultivate it, the Jewish community who in Germany had been shopkeepers and those who actually serviced these German Germans, they came over and continued to do the same thing in the German language. By the way, Dallas, the city where I was a rabbi for 11 years, was actually started by Jews because it was a central location where they could warehouse the goods that were then sent or brought to El Paso and San Antonio and Austin and all the Houston and all these others. And then they started with the living there to be able to service until it grew and grew, and now the Jewish community is so much part of Dallas. I mean, I was there for 11 years, and it's amazing how well integrated the Jewish community is, you say. I think you have to find a way of having the Muslim communities, especially the mosques, not to be so isolated. They have to invite people to speak. They have to find ways of having the imams come and speak.
Right. Last Saturday, I was behind the pulpit at the largest conservative synagogue in Durham, North Carolina.
Good.
As part of the worship service. And in the history of 120-some years of that synagogue, I'm the first Muslim clergy to be there, even present, let alone just speaking behind the pulpit and being part of the worship service. And it was a amazing moment of hallelujah for everybody.
Yeah. Imagine if you replicate that with, let's say, 300 imams in 300 congregations.
Yes, yes.
Just think of the difference.
Yes, yes.
Everybody would go home and say, you know, that's not what I've been reading in the papers. That's not what I've been seeing on TV.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? That's your statement at Seton Hall, I can't tell you the number of people who were completely moved by what you said at Seton Hall when we had a report on the trip to Auschwitz.
Yes.
Now, but why should it be only you? Do you see my point?
Yes, yes.
It has to be, you have to get a whole series of people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be going back in April to meet with the imams in San Antonio. And we're trying to bring other imams. And I was on the phone this morning to try to get leaders in the Christian community to meet with me, so that we would really establish proper relationships between the Christian and Jewish community. By the way, it was a rabbi that brought the imams. You know that.
Interesting.
Sam Stahl, who was the rabbi emeritus of the largest Reform congregation in San Antonio, brought his imam friends. And so, you know, why not build on that? Why not find out who are the imams that know which clergy, and how do we empower them to continue these meetings and go to the press and get these meetings reported on?
Yes. And as you said, it cannot be just individual efforts. This should be done in a concerted and more coordinated efforts, and implemented and repeated across the board more and more, over and over.
Exactly.
Sometimes appearing in a few places, making few talks, you think the problem is done. But the message of vilification and dehumanization is being repeated dozens of times a day.
Exactly.
At least we should be able to, represent and develop an alternative narrative as often as what's being told, unfortunately, on the media and elsewhere. Do you think, we talked about similarities between the Jewish experience and the Muslim experience. Are there some differences that we can learn? One of the differences that I can see, Jews came to this country 150 years ago, 100 years ago, in different waves, from different parts of the world, but mostly they were not middle class or upper middle class when they first arrived.
Well, it varies. For example, The first Jews that came here, as I say, was in 1654. And then for the next 100 years, there were not that many Jews coming in. Then in the middle of the 19th century, you had a very large migration of European Jews, mainly German. And then in the between 1890 and 1910, you had over 1.7 million Jews from Eastern Europe. Now, in every one of these instances, these were middle-class Jews.
I see.
But they, when they came to this country, doesn't mean that they were engaging in middle-class occupations. They were engaging in, I would say, lower-class, in the sweatshops. But since they had a middle-class mentality, the first thing they wanted to do was educate their children, send them to college, so that they would become professionals. And that's why you have so many Jews in the professions today. Lawyers, doctors, accountants, you know.
And even the public.
Managers and so forth.
Even the public service, you see, whenever I go to D.C., I mean, their representation in serving in the government, U.S. government, is also very, very significant.
Yes, I think because, and one of the reasons is because learning was one of the really most important Jewish virtues. In other words, you're not only supposed to learn Torah. First of all, every Jew has to learn enough Hebrew to be able to read the Torah. But apart from that, learning was important. You literally had to learn. And if you spend years learning, even if you're just learning one thing, it makes it easier for you to learn a lot of other things.
Of course, of course.
And so that's why, for example, in the universities, I mean, Jews literally excelled. Why, for example, do you have so many Jewish lawyers that are so good? Because you can't study the Talmud without studying law.
Yes.
It's as simple as that.
Yes. It is identical in Islam. I think learning is a commandment.
Yes,
learning
exactly.
is an act of worship. Learning is the one of the most beautiful ways of glorifying God.
Well, that's one of the things
God's
that unites
name.
Muslims and Jews.
But I think the Muslim migration, especially among the immigrant Muslim community who came after 1965, our understanding and ability to learning was slightly different, because I think most people who came after 1965, they were the cream of the crop of the Muslim world.
Right.
They came as graduate students and engineers and doctors professionally. And in their understanding and following of American dream, they concentrated only with certain professions.
Yes.
That's one of the difficulties within the Muslim community, that our brightest are not necessarily spread around the spectrum of different professions, and definitely not in the service industry or serving in the government, etc. There is a huge imbalance in favor of science, in favor of medicine, in favor of engineering, that we keep sending our brightest and the most skilled men and women to those professions, but that creates a challenge in itself. Then the Muslim representation is concentrated in certain areas. People do not see how Muslims give back to the community.
Yes.
People do not necessarily see significant names within the Muslim community serving for the government, for the public education system, for the media, etc.
I think you're right, and I think this is another problem.
Yes, yes.
The visibility is not there.
People don't see it. I mean, a lot of people say, I have never met a Muslim. And I ask their doctor's name. I mean, one in three instances, their doctor's name or their physician's name, their specialist name sounds Muslim.
Yes.
Or people working in the engineering world, there is a overwhelmingly imbalance that Muslims are concentrated in certain professions. That creates a problem in itself. One another thing also I would like to tap into your experience and wisdom, Jack, is how did the Jewish community produce certain public figures from media to politics to entertainment to sports? And I think they played a far significant role in challenging the stereotypes about Jews and Judaism. And they sort of humanized Judaism as a religion and Jews as people in the hearts and minds of many people in this country. I believe, was there a concerted effort to produce these public figures?
I don't think it was a concerted effort. I think that, like, for example, take Hollywood. Now, Hollywood, in large measure, was largely developed by Jews. And I think that they are very interested in communications. And I think that the Jewish people, qua people, are devoted, A, to learning. That's by far the most important thing. Secondly, to finding a way of integrating into the community of which they are a part.
Mm.
And so it was never a sense that we have to be only with our own.
Mm.
Even those that were very Orthodox still felt the obligation to be part of the community,
mm.
contribute to the community. Well, let me give you an example. If you were to go to, say, the Metropolitan Museum in New York,
right,
or to Lincoln Center,
mm.
and look at all of the people who are the contributors and the sustainers of the sympathies, of the museums, of the hospitals,
mm.
even a Methodist hospital or a Catholic hospital, it's Jews. Jews really take very seriously
mm.
the commandment to give to charity. Now, I know that's central in Islam,
mm.
but it's not just to Jews.
Right.
In other words, you have large buildings in all of the medical schools, in all of the hospitals
mm-hmm.
that were literally, I mean, one of my very closest friends, Russ Berry, who was the one that actually founded our center with me, the Center for Interreligious Understanding. Well, he gave $14 million to Columbia for a diabetes center. He gave $5 million to Holy Name, which is a Catholic hospital,
mm.
for a diagnostic center. He gave $5 million to Englewood Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these aren't Jewish hospitals.
Right, right. Here,
and
here
at Duke, he gave to
here
the community.
At Duke, that's the case. I know, I mean, myself, I mean, I go to Duke Hospital and see Jewish names on floors or departments or
yeah.
research centers.
Yes. Like the president of my Center for Interreligious Understanding gave a wing at Columbia University for ophthalmological studies.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, these are things that that have to be appreciated, that the Jewish community is an extraordinarily generous community.
Yes, yes. They give.
And they're not unwilling to give tremendous quantities of money.
Hmm.
I mean, think of the money that's been given to Israel for education,
hmm.
like at the Technion set,
hmm.
which is one of the great institutions of the world.
Right, right.
You see, that kind of thing.
Hmm. In terms of the producing public figures, like all these known Jewish public figures, like Seinfeld, in my previous Blog Chat TV interview, I told to Mona that I really pray for a Muslim Seinfeld.
Yes.
I am hoping that there will be some figures who, by and large, will be known with their Muslim identity. And there are some public figures, but their Muslim identity or their affiliation with Islam is either downplayed or not known at all.
Yeah, well, like, for example, I mean, I don't watch TV, so I'm the last person to comment on that. But Jon Stewart, the few times I have watched him, very often he'll say, well, you know, I'm Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
He has no hesitation to make it very clear to everyone that he's Jewish.
Right.
I think that's an important thing, and that he's proud of it.
That is very important.
He's not ashamed of being Jewish. You see the point I'm making?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
But how to...
Johnny?
Hello?
Oh, no, I'm calling Johnny. Go ahead.
How to create that sense of obligation in all the Jewish organizations that we talked earlier? Would you agree with me that in their board of trustees, you will find Jews of all persuasions, like you would find in the board of all these civic secular Jewish organizations, very strictly Orthodox observing, practicing Jewish person, and also a shrimp eating Jew or no Shabbat observing Jew sitting on the board of an organization and working for a common cause?
Oh, absolutely.
Interesting.
That happens all the time.
I don't think we have similar. Coalition, a broad spectrum of Muslim representation, any Muslim organization that I know. People usually create organizations or come together with the like-minded people.
And yeah, but you have to find some greater good that the Muslim community should unite. And that greater good is the prevention of the continuing stereotyping and vilification and character assassination. Mm-hmm.
If this is not a greater good enough, I don't know what it is. I mean,
what could be greater than that?
Going through the kind of summer that we went through in pre-November elections, and what has been going on since then, and all the preparation to November 12th elections, again, Islam will be a major material to be used to promote a culture of fear. And the constant vilification will only increase. I just do not know, and I'm addressing to fellow Muslims in the United States and all over, if this is not a greater good that we can forget about our differences and come together and unite and help our fellow American citizens in order to understand actually who we are and what we stand for and our contribution to society. I don't know what is greater good if this is not.
I agree with you, and I think that, look, the reality is that this kind of a discussion has to take place within the Muslim community. And as I suggested before, you should pick, let's say, 15 blue ribbon Muslims, some from the academic world, some from finance, some from the professions, some in communication, and say, look, we have a real challenge. We can't do it. We have to hire somebody. Because, by the way, it shouldn't be a Muslim group to do it. We have to hire someone who will rebrand it, who will teach us how to communicate, who has the contacts with the press, with TV, with the movies, with everyone, and to be able to begin to tell the story. And we have to have someone who knows how to tell the story, who knows how to convey it. Because in all honesty, I can tell you that in the years that I've worked, half the time I don't know what I'm doing. I had to listen to people who were communicators.
Yes.
And said, look, you want to be heard or not? If you want to be heard, you have to say it in this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think you need professional help here.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. You need organizations like Edelman and companies who knows how to shape public image,
exactly.
Who knows how to get your message out there and make accessible to...
Well, let me give you an example. Just hiring for a pittance, Susan Barnett, who for reasons that are, you know, another was not able to come to Auschwitz, but who was on the phone with media constantly, day and night. We got tremendous, tremendous exposure to that. You see, now imagine if you had 10 Susan Barnetts.
Yes, 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 yes.
Or who would do it all the time, not just on one item.
Right, right. And specifically focusing on this issue of Islamophobia and other issues.
Yes,
exactly. That could definitely make a huge difference.
Yes.
Well,
I think that's the problem.
What?
I always feel more encouraged and enriched whenever I talk to you. I think.
Well, Abdullah, it's always a joy. It's always a joy to speak to you and to be your friend. And I greatly appreciate everything you've done and everything you stand for and everything you're doing for really better understanding and a genuine sense of love between all of the various religions. You're really a great inspiration to me.
Thank you very much. And you are a source of inspiration and educational learning and mentor to me as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And to be continued, I guess.
Right, absolutely. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.